From Washington, D.C., across the nation and around the world, stand by for an overview of the hottest topics and people being discussed on air, online, at the coffee shop and across the backyard fence, powered by the research of Talkers Magazine, The National Conversation. It's time for the Michael Harrison Wrap. Here's Michael Harrison.
Thank you, Victoria Jones. Monday, September 20th through Friday, September 24th, 2021. It was a week of humanitarian crises from all ends of the spectrum, including immigration, international relations, climactic turmoil, and that damn miserable, stinking, mysterious microbe, arbitrarily labeled COVID-19, that's screwing with our lives, institutions, and relationships big time. Stand by, as we're about to embark upon a bold hour of Black Belt Talk Radio, during which your tolerance for hearing different but legitimate points of view will be tested. We've got colorful, well-meaning individuals waiting in the wings to tickle your brain with notions and emotions. So try not to get angry. Just listen and maintain an appropriate amount of educated skepticism. We'll hear from Gary Sutton of WSBA in York, Pennsylvania, with his take on the hot topics of the week. Dr. Murray Sabrin in Naples, Florida, discussing his leading-edge libertarian approach to the healthcare crisis in America. Dr. Dahlia Wax in Las Vegas, Nevada, delivering the latest medical poop on boosters, vaccines, and the confusing, often conflicting, data about the pandemic, along with broadcasting executive, journalist, and historian Joe Garner, talking about the evolution of that heart-stopping phrase, "We interrupt this broadcast." Opinionated yappers from across the country with microphones, smartphones, and digital recording devices sharing their observations as well as the feelings of their target constituents with whom they do their daily dance of affirmation in a fragmented, noisy world in which we try against all odds and forces to avoid the modern-day syndrome of seeking victory at the expense of truth. Welcome to the Michael Harrison Wrap, heard coast to coast and around the world on great radio stations in the U.S. and the U.K., a hyper-verbal examination of the past week's hottest political and social topics discussed in the American talk media and played out in the theater of your mind. Information's gathered from a variety of sources, including data tracked by the broadcasting trade publication Talkers Magazine, of which I'm editor and publisher. Fasten your Sea Crane CC earbuds. Speaking of which, this installment of the Michael Harrison Wrap is being sponsored in part by the good folks at Sea Crane, makers and distributors of fine radio and radio-oriented equipment. Visit their website at seacrane.com or give them a call at 800-522-8863. Okay, here we go. Joining us now is Kevin Casey, executive editor of Talkers Magazine. Kevin, give us a rundown of the 10 most talked about stories on talk shows in America this past week.
Thank you, Michael. At number 10, race relations tied with the Gabby Petito case. The mysterious death of Gabby Petito, whose travel blog Van Life had a significant following on YouTube and other platforms, and her missing fiancé Brian Laundrie has captured the attention of the media and the nation.
It's also shined the spotlight of scrutiny on a phenomenon known as missing white woman syndrome.
At number 9, Facebook and social media issues. It was revealed this week that Facebook overpaid the Federal Trade Commission by nearly $5 billion in an alleged quid pro quo to protect CEO Mark Zuckerberg from being sued individually by the agency.
Just another in a nonstop series of stories and events that question the honesty and integrity of the social media giant and probe its alleged role in undermining the fabric of our society.
At number 8 this week, the January 6 investigation tied with Donald Trump's ongoing claims of election fraud. The drumbeat of investigation goes on as the Select Congressional Committee began issuing its first round of subpoenas this week, targeting close aides and allies of former President Trump.
These include former Trump White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, former Deputy Chief of Staff Dan Scavino, former advisor Steve Bannon, and Kash Patel, a former Chief of Staff to then-acting Secretary of Defense Christopher Miller.
At number 7, abortion tied with voting rights legislation. The aftershock of the Texas anti-abortion law continues to reverberate across the nation.
As does the new intensified Texas voting legislation just put into effect. All this puts Texas Governor Greg Abbott into the position of being one of the most controversial politicians in America today.
At number 6, climate change. Climate change was a key topic at the big UN summit meeting in New York this week, as the Biden administration has finalized a rule to phase down the use of a powerful planet-warming chemical used in air conditioners and refrigerators.
The Environmental Protection Agency will reduce the use of hydrofluorocarbons, or HFCs, by 85% over the next 15 years.
At number 5, U.S.-China relations. The brouhaha with France that we'll be noting as we move up this list is directly connected to U.S. efforts to fortify its alliances with Great Britain and Australia in the Pacific to offset growing Chinese military influence in the region.
And the role of the Chinese pertaining to the origins of the Wuhan coronavirus and the dissemination of information regarding its spread continues to be a murky cause of deep concern to America and its allies.
At number 4, a three-way tie between immigration, Afghanistan, and Haiti. The refugee pressure spawned by the debacle in Afghanistan and suffering in Haiti has intensified the nation's coming to grips with immigration law enforcement and reform.
The humanitarian crisis along the border continues to worsen as the Biden administration struggles to come up with solutions to the problem or show measurable signs of positive action.
At number 3, the economy and the Biden budget. The $3.5 trillion budget bill continues to be debated among Democrats as well as Republicans.
Meantime, shortages in the labor market, slowdowns in the supply chain, and uncertainty due to the economic impact of the surging Delta variant continue to fuel fears of inflation among economists.
At number 2, the UN meeting and U.S.-France relations. President Biden tried to assure world leaders at the gathering in New York City that America was back to being itself and that our allies could count on the U.S. for steady and dependable leadership going forward.
But it was clear that not everyone in the audience was confident that the words of the president would lead to any dependable action, especially France, which, although having outwardly cooled off a bit in response to Biden's reassurances, remains burned and miffed by the Pacific submarine deal struck between the U.S., the U.K., and Australia.
And at number 1 this week, COVID-19 boosters, vaccines, masks, mandates, and politics. The COVID-19 death toll in America stands at 675,000 and has now surpassed that of the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic.
COVID-19 vaccine boosters can officially begin for certain groups of adults after the CDC approved the decision and recommended boosters for people ages 65 and older, residents of long-term care facilities, certain people with underlying medical conditions, and people ages 18 to 64 who are at increased risk of COVID-19 because of their workplaces or institutional settings. Thank you, Kevin Casey from Talkers Magazine. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. One of my favorite American radio talk show hosts is heard each morning on WSBA in the city of York, Pennsylvania. He's a former school teacher who approaches the most controversial issues in an even-handed and good-natured manner. His name is Gary Sutton. The United Nations meeting, what was your approach to that on the air and callers? How did they feel about it?
Well, I think the idea that President Biden is dealing with a whole lot of issues on the national scene right now certainly laid the background for that. And then coming out and basically talking about relentless diplomacy. I think there are a lot of people that came to that meeting at the United Nations saying, you know, can we really trust the United States anymore? I mean, we look at what happened with France last week with the submarine deal with Australia, and France, you know, throwing a fit. Now President Biden has been able to kind of patch that up, and they're going to send their ambassador back to Washington. We have what we saw in Afghanistan, allies around the world wondering about, did we let them down in that regard in the way that we got out of there? We've got a lot of different things. And I think the problem that we had with the whole United Nations thing right now, Michael, is the idea that the world is waiting to see who the United States is now under Joe Biden. I don't mean to sound like Captain Obvious here, but obviously the story that has been painted by Biden and his administration has been, hey, we're going to return to some normalcy, some maturity in the way we're going to operate. We have people now who know what they're doing on the national stage. We have people who know what they're doing in all these situations. And I'm not sure everybody's buying on that right now. And again, I'm rooting for President Biden to make it, because when he makes it, my country makes it as well. But by the same token, you know, you have to be critical of the actions when they have raised some questions. I think a lot of people around the world right now have some serious doubts about where we're going, because we don't seem to be able to put exclamation points on anything right now. There are still a lot of question marks laying out there. So I think that was the backdrop for the United Nations. I thought the president tried to make his point there, But it's sounding kind of hollow right now because there's not a lot of meat on the bone at the moment. And I think people are waiting to see what that meat on the bone is going to look like.
It's interesting. A lot of people are claiming that Biden's policies are more like Trump than they are like Obama. So it makes you wonder, you know, do people want to go, people who are critical of Biden, does that mean they want to go back to Trumpism? Or are we in a situation now where both of the isms, you know, the Biden approach and Trumpism leave a lot of people feeling, you know, disoriented and, you know, disenfranchised? What are your thoughts about that?
You know, my thought is this, and it's a simple one. I think people want to get back to what an American country is really all about. Trumpism is a side. Bidenism is a side, or you know, whatever ism you want to throw in there right now.
Right.
But the problem is people are worn out. They're fatigued with this. But it's all we know right now. It's a language that we're talking. And especially on the political stage, I mean, you see votes taken this week on the debt limit and so forth, and everything's always going to be all the Democrats voted for this, all the Republicans voted against it. I mean, people are tired of it, but they don't know. It's been so long since we sat down and we really had a discussion where two sides were listening and really trying to arrive at decent policy that we've forgotten what that even looks like anymore. And so here we are now where Biden comes in and he wants to get rid of everything that was Trump when he comes into the presidency, right? And yet now he's finding at the border, oh, geez, maybe we shouldn't have asked all these people to come right away. Oh, my gosh, we've got to do some of the things that Trump would have done. How do we, you know, and then you say, well, it was his fault. You know, we got to stop this. Laying fault with other people, we got to stop this whole sideism kind of thing and get back to talking about what is good for the country. And the whole thing with the Haitians, your heart bleeds for people when you see people there in that kind of poverty. And yet at the same time, you know, we have rules. How is it helping our country in the way that we're going to bring people in here? And when we bring people in here, for example, from the immigration standpoint, no one ever talks about this. I want people who come in here to have the same right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness that I have. Not some life, not some liberty, not some happiness, but the whole thing. And I'm a guy that thinks you got to do it through the front door. I don't know. I guess I'm old-fashioned, Michael, but that's kind of where I sit with that whole deal right now. But again, we have the dishonesty of politics at the moment, too, and I think that's one of the things that people abhor at the moment. When we look, for example, we see these Haitians camped on the bridge down in Del Rio, Texas, 15,000 people there, and what do we hear? Oh, they're being sent back. And then we hear, oh, well, 500 got sent back, but now we have thousands being brought into the country to await hearings. They're given papers. They're being shipped to various places in the country with these papers that said you have to appear at court 2 weeks. Really? Are we that naive? Are we that stupid in our country right now that we're going to buy that? And if we are, then we probably deserve what we're going to get in the long run.
What about the media's role in all of this? I mean, if there's such a murkiness and such a, you know, it's so unclear as to what's happening, do you think the media bears responsibility for this in some manner?
I think at the very least they're a catalyst. And again, I think they get caught in the same thing, Michael, and I don't know how you feel about this, but they get caught in that same side. The media is not really doing their investigative part. Now, that's, you know, move over. I'm about the millionth person who said that. But the point is they're not doing their part in terms of really digging down right now. Although I will say this, I am starting to see more questions asked than I thought I would see at this particular point in time of the administration. They're trying to color it. Well, here's what's happening. You got to go along on our side because you're always on our side. And they're saying, maybe not so much. There's a point. There might be a point of demarcation coming up, which I think would be positive, where people are saying, hey, the truth is the truth. No matter if you like it or you don't like it, that's where it's headed. And this idea of drawing the sides might be at least getting a chink in the armor right now. Does that make any sense?
Makes total sense. And I know that you do your best to keep things, you know, as accurate as possible. But, you know, we're only as good as the information we hear in the media. In conclusion, just a quick take. How's the feeling in your community about COVID at this point?
I think people are looking at it in the sense of, and for example, the way I looked at it with the shots and so forth, there's still a debate, but I think the debate is lessening because we've had a lot of our hospitals in our community overwhelmed with COVID recently. My wife is a healthcare professional, as you know, Michael, and she told me some of the numbers. And the fact is the numbers show up and say, hey, 90% of the people who are sick in hospitals right now who are on ventilators and so forth are unvaccinated. The other people are not. I'm an old coach from 41 years. I used to look at the scoreboard and I'd say, hey, the score says what it says at the end. I don't listen to the Faucis. I don't listen to the Bidens. I don't listen to the governors. I don't listen to all of them. I listen to the people who are working in those atmospheres. And from all they tell me, those are the numbers. We need to make sure that we are careful. We need to make sure that we're vaccinated. It's no different than any other vaccine that we use, like the flu. We're coming into flu season right now. And I think also the masking thing, I think there's a lot of people that, get kind of nuts about that right now. I'm not sure where the end game is on that whole thing. All I will do is say this. Look at the football stadiums like Penn State's whiteout last weekend and tell me how many masks you see and how many outbreaks we have. I don't know. Maybe the mask isn't all it's cut out to be, but that debate continues to rage on. But, yeah, we still have the debates going on in our area as well, Mike, as I'm sure they are all over the country.
That's the long-running popular host of The Morning Show at WSBA in York, Pennsylvania, Gary Sutton. Coming up next, a look at the healthcare crisis in America from the perspective of one of the nation's most respected libertarian voices. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. Hey, fellow radio lover. C. Crane specializes in high-quality radios and radio-oriented audio products. Last week, I told you about C. Crane CC Pocket Radio. Well, this week, it's C. Crane CC Radio 2E. Now, what makes the CC Radio 2E a better radio? It's simple. Tune your average radio to a weak AM station, then try C. Crane CC Radio 2E right next to it. The CC Radio 2E is one of the best AM and FM radios made today. It's designed to receive long-range AM and FM stations and make weak signals strong. The 2E also sets weather with alert, which makes for a great emergency radio. The high-quality audio from the CC Radio 2E sounds like the host is sitting right next to you. Choose a radio that you'll be happy with for years. I recommend the CC Radio 2E from C. Crane, which has the power to bring the signal in better. To order the CC Radio 2E, call 800-522-8863. That's 800-522-8863, or visit them online at ccrane.com. Continuing now with the Michael Harrison Wrap. COVID-19 continues to be the dominating conversation not only of the past several weeks, but of this entire era, now deep into its second year. Our next guest is one of the most prolific talk show guests of the past three decades. His name is Dr. Murray Sabrin, and he's the retired professor emeritus of finance at New Jersey's Ramapo College. He's also a prolific author and even ran for the governorship of New Jersey back in the late 90s as the Libertarian Party nominee. He's considered one of America's most articulate spokespersons on the libertarian movement. His latest book is titled Universal Medical Care from Conception to the End of Life, The Case for a Single-Payer System, published by Page Publishing. Murray, there's so much talk about the healthcare system because of COVID that your new book couldn't be more timely. And you are one of the most effective speakers on the libertarian point of view, not just in healthcare, but in every end of finance. How has COVID exposed some of the flaws in our medical system that you've been talking about for years?
Well, the first thing is that we have sort of top-down medical care where presidents, CDC are issuing guidelines. Governors have issued draconian lockdown measures and other fiat decrees when they should be in consultation with the legislature. It should be a participatory decision about what to do. But basically, the point is people need to take care of themselves. And I've been preaching this for decades. I've been personally taking care of myself now that I'm nearly 75 years old. I don't have any major illnesses. People need to take responsibility for their personal health situation. And that, I think, is one of the flaws we're seeing right now in this COVID situation.
One of the things that I have heard you talk about is the sickness of the American people. And sickness, you put in quotes. Does that relate to what you just said?
Well, absolutely. The numbers show very clearly 75% of the people who died from COVID are obese. 95% of the people who died from COVID have comorbidities, type 2 diabetes, heart problems, hypertension, kidney problems. So in other words, the American people, if they're not healthy, are very susceptible to viruses. And this is why it's important to build up your immune system. That's why I've been working with a naturopath for the last 20 years to build up our immune system, my wife and I, so we can ward off any sort of illnesses that come our way. And that's the essence of being an adult and taking care of your own health.
One of the things that you talk about also is why medicine and government should be separated, like government and religion. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah. Medical care is one of the most personal, intimate things in our lives. Outside of marriage or a long-term personal relationship, a doctor is someone we trust, who we should be trusting in order to give us good advice and good treatment for our medical care, and we have to ask the right questions. It's important that people trust their doctors, get a second opinion if necessary. This past year, I had a medical condition, not a major one, but I got a second opinion, and I got the condition taken care of. And so we need to be proactive. We need to be intelligent, enlightened about our own bodies and what we need to do in order to maintain our optimal health.
You know, you mentioned you have had a health situation and dealt with it. I'm dealing with a minor health situation myself, and there's nothing like having your own health situation to give you a firsthand view of what you hear a lot of other people complaining about. And then you go, oh, they're right. What's going on? The argument has always been that if we had universal health care provided by the government, we'd have to wait months and months and months before we get a doctor. People say, oh, yeah, it's free here, but you know, try getting an operation, try getting a doctor, try getting into a clinic, and it could take forever. Whereas in the private situation where the government is not running health care, it works much better. But what I'm finding lately, and doctors are complaining to me about it personally and privately, you can't even get a damn appointment with a doctor. And this is the private sector. This is, you know, the way we're doing it now. You can't get an appointment with a doctor sometimes for months. And with the insurance situation, you can't get a damn CAT scan or an MRI without going through hurdles, in spite of the fact that your doctor might recommend it. Does anything work anymore?
Well, this is why what we have today is a hybrid system of Medicare, Medicaid, third-party insurance. What we need is the model that I'm proposing in my book, which is where people are in charge by having direct payment for their doctor. They have a super savings account, super medical savings account, where they put money in. It grows tax-free. They take it out tax-free, and that pays for most of their medical bills. And then a catastrophic policy, God forbid that a person needs a major operation, that they would be bankrupt, but they have a catastrophic policy to take care of that. And the fourth component, which is the key, is nonprofit medical centers across this country that can be created very easily by all the billionaires who want to do good for the American people, can fund the creation of several thousand of them, and that would eliminate the Medicaid budget of over $600 billion a year. So my book talks about the actual components of what it would take to have universal medical care right on the shoulders of the American people, where they pay for their needs instead of the government, which, of course, the government is just a check writer. And we know from experience in Canada and the UK, you have to wait months and months and months for a knee operation, which in America could take a few weeks to do. And so that's why bureaucracy doesn't work, whether it's in healthcare or transportation or housing or every sector of the economy. That's what the evidence shows. That's what the theories show. We need to have a free market, because the free market gets goods to the people at lower and lower prices. That's been the history of America for the past 200 years.
Are there enough altruistic billionaires to actually come through and pull off what you just described?
Absolutely, because they all claim to be altruists and philanthropists. Michael Bloomberg, for example, one of his key contributions is to healthcare. The Gates Foundation, they have, what, $55 billion. If Bill Gates wants to do something great for the American people, he should partner with the other billionaires, Warren Buffett, who donates 4% of his net worth to the Gates Foundation, to create these nonprofit health centers. I helped create one in Bergen County, New Jersey. I also support two others in New Jersey, and I hope to support some here in Southwest Florida. This is the epitome of American altruism and voluntarism that's been part of the American culture for 200 years.
That's renowned libertarian spokesperson, college professor, and author Dr. Murray Sabrin. His latest book, Universal Medical Care from Conception to the End of Life, The Case for a Single-Payer System, published by Page Publishing, is available on Amazon. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. Let's pivot from one aspect of healthcare to another. Joining us now from Las Vegas, Nevada, is our medical correspondent, a nationally syndicated radio talk show host heard coast to coast every day on the Genesis Communications Network, Dr. Dahlia Wax. Dr. Wax, I want to talk a little bit about COVID, but I want to ask you another question because I just finished an interview that preceded this with a famous libertarian scholar who talks about the differences between universal medical care and basically the way we have it now. And one of the questions I asked him, I'm going to ask you, why does it seem to be, even in the system we have right now, increasingly difficult to get a doctor's appointment with a new doctor, or even to see the doctor you have? Like, the waiting times are longer and longer. And why is it suddenly difficult to get a CAT scan or an MRI, things of that nature, more difficult than they were, say, a year, two or three ago?
Fantastic question. So the labor shortage has plagued the healthcare industry just as much as many of the others. A lot of doctors have left as well. A lot of doctors, when they, once you lock down and somebody is considering retirement, many of them left. So I'm hearing, and I'm licensed in 12 states, so it's all across the United States, where when a doctor leaves, another doctor has to take on their patients. So new patients are kind of in the back of the line. On top of that, we still have a lot of people who are ill, many people that are trying to catch up, so there's bottlenecking, but a doctor is only as good as their staff. And if staff aren't coming back to work, then a doctor can only do so much, and that's the rate-limiting step.
Doesn't that throw a monkey wrench into the old debate of, you know, government health care versus private health care? Do you want to have to wait 3 months to get a knee operation? You know, that type of thing. It's sort of thrown that binary argument out the window.
Exactly. You know, so one thing that was really nice is, like you said, with CAT scan, you know, if a doctor wanted to order a CAT scan, they could order it. And we didn't have to go through all the bureaucracy. The problem is demand and supply is now equating what a public option bureaucracy could look like. I don't think a public option would improve that. I don't think a government-run healthcare would improve it. But I do see us going that direction, as many private doctors are already starting to work for companies, and companies are already monetizing medicine. And so I do foresee us going socialized. I'm not a fan of it, but I don't see how we could stop it, because the old family doc, the neighborhood family doc that I tried to be, I couldn't do. After the ACA, I had to close my doors, and a single family doc can't do it anymore on their own.
Well, without going down that rabbit hole, because it is indeed a deep one, I have one more question along these lines, and I want to discuss COVID real quickly. Isn't this a great opportunity because of the labor shortage for people to go into the medical profession, to become a nurse, to become a doctor?
You know, it is. It is. In fact, any industry right now, I mean, it's hot and people are offering money, you know, offering money and all that. But one thing that people are seeing is the doctors and nurses and healthcare workers are being mistreated. They're underpaid. They aren't being paid more. They're being overworked. Many nurses who wanted support, you know, in terms of not getting the vaccine because they have immunity and they haven't gotten sick throughout the whole course, they don't feel like the hospitals have their back. And so I think a lot of people are seeing that it's not as glorified a job as it once used to be. And I don't see a lot of enthusiasm for people wanting to go into the medical field since COVID.
So aside from the COVID factor and the risks therein, it's kind of a myth that the doctors are raking in all the dough. You know, become a doctor, you'll be set for life, and they complain a lot, but that's only because they can only play golf twice a week as opposed to three times a week, you know?
Absolutely. I wouldn't be in radio if I was raking in the dough.
And you're such, and the amazing thing is, and I could testify to this, I will endorse it, you're a very good doctor. So it's not like, you know, if you can't do it, you teach it, or
right.
A lot of media yeah. experts aren't really experts. No, you're the real deal.
It's wonderful. Radio gave me a platform to educate more patients and more people. And so it's the best thing I could have ever done. And I look at radio as a extension of my medical practice in terms of being able to help people as well as entertain. And I love it. But doctors, they're not on yachts. You know, the celebrities are, but not doctors.
What about now the tremendous amount of conversation about the efficacy and the politics of boosters? Where do you stand?
Great. So, you know, we've had a lot of callers. Boosters are a little bit confusing because there was the back and forth with the White House and the FDA. The CDC had recommended high-risk groups get a booster, and now the FDA did an emergency authorization for a booster. So people are confused as to, is that the same thing? So roughly what happened is Pfizer has been emergency authorized for a single dose booster if it's been 6 months, not the 8 months the White House said, 6 months from your last dose. If you're over 65, if you're high risk, immunocompromised. But the question is what if you were a Moderna recipient or a Johnson & Johnson recipient, and the FDA has not yet said they're okay with people mixing and matching. So I've been telling people, when it comes to you getting a booster, it's between you and your doctor. If your doctor wants you to get a booster, you get one. You know, whether it's Moderna, Pfizer, and then it looks like there are still shots available for people who are at high risk to get them.
Do you think there's any danger in mixing and matching? I mean, the question is whether or not they are as efficient, but does it unleash some type of a deadly potion if you mix one formula with another?
Yeah, fantastic question. It's not supposed to. If everything we're being told about the ingredients are correct, then there shouldn't, especially with the delay in getting the different vaccines, because look at how the flu shot is different each year. You know, there shouldn't be any sort of mixture or, you know, contraindication. But because everything has to be studied and they want to make sure somebody doesn't have a more exaggerated allergic response as opposed to just staying along their same thread of Pfizer or Moderna, they want to be cautious before they recommend it. Have some people mix and matched? Yes, they have. We just don't have a lot of data on that.
And the final question, I'm still hearing all over the radio, all over the country on talk shows, controversy over some of these alternative measures, ivermectin, you know, hydroxychloroquine keeps coming up, that type of thing. Are we becoming more enlightened, less enlightened? Is it totally politicized? Where do you stand on that?
Oh, fantastic question. So, yes, more data is coming out on ivermectin that looks very interesting and very promising. So the FDA and I believe the CDC on their website even said, look, it's in clinical trials. So even though it's not recommended yet, not FDA approved, it's still being studied. Probenecid used for gout has made some headlines with some promising data against the virus and preventing replication. So I think we're getting closer. The politicization has got to stop so scientists can do their work, because the sooner we have adjuncts and additional medical treatments, the faster we could fight the pandemic.
That's medical doctor and radio talk show host Dr. Dahlia Wax of the Genesis Communications Network. Coming up next, we're going to interrupt this broadcast with something about interrupting broadcasts. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap.
This report is brought to you by Genesis 2 Project, G2P. Recently, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, the ODNI, released a preliminary report on possible threats posed by UFOs, now known as Unidentified Aerial Phenomena, UAP, and the progress the Department of Defense UAP Task Force has made in understanding any threats. Dr. J.C. Van Valkenburg is a former Los Alamos National Lab biophysicist who has been working with G2P to bring scientifically sound UAP data to the public.
G2P has released the first scientifically authenticated documentation of UAPs, including images captured with infrared technology. Primo Forensics performed the digital forensic analysis.
In tandem with the ODNI report, these data support the development of relevant processes, policies, technologies, and training for the U.S. military and government personnel upon encountering UAP. Visit Genesis2Project.com.
Continuing now with the Michael Harrison Wrap as we discuss the hottest topics of the past week in the national conversation. I recently conducted a conversation for my podcast, The Michael Harrison Interview, with radio executive Joe Garner. Joe's a six-time New York Times bestselling author. His seminal multimedia book, We Interrupt This Broadcast, innovatively combined audio, photographs, and text. It sold more than 1 million copies and has for two decades now served as a go-to chronicle of America's broadcast history. Now it's been adapted into a docu-series podcast titled We Interrupt This Broadcast. Before it was history, it was news, hosted by broadcasting legend Bill Curtis and narrated by Brian Williams. The 12-episode series revisits the dramatic "Where Were You When?" moments, and they're told exclusively from the perspective of the broadcasters and TV journalists who reported them.
I was at Westwood One Radio Networks. I was there for about 10 or 11 years, and this was now the late 90s. I was in a meeting. And we were talking about creating programming to commemorate the passing of the 20th century into the 21st century. And, you know, we were talking about events like the Kennedy assassination, the Apollo 11 moon landing, the O.J. Simpson saga, all this. And I got back to my office and I was struck by how everybody in that room seemed to have just this. They were compelled to share a story of where they were when. I started thinking about these events and how they'd become more than defining moments in history. They'd become the benchmarks in our lives, the where were you when moments. We all share these moments. And then it occurred to me that every one of the events, the common denominator was they were introduced to us with the same four chilling words. We interrupt this broadcast. And literally in that instant, what became my first book began to sort of crystallize in my mind. I thought, you know, this could be something that could be sort of a national scrapbook. Tell all of these stories, illustrate them with the iconic imagery that's inextricable with the memory of the event. But because we live in such a wonderful age where our history is literally recorded, I thought I could bring these to life by including the actual bulletins and news coverage for each of the events that I wrote about in the book. And 1990s technology was CD, and I thought, well, the CDs would easily tuck into the inside back cover. Mm-hmm. I didn't know the first thing about publishing, nothing, but I felt so strongly about this book that I pulled a book of broadcast history off my shelves, looked at the publisher's name, and I called them. And I cold called and cold called and cold called and got blown out of every publishing house in New York City, finally introduced to this little publisher in Naperville, Illinois, who said, I'll do this on one condition. And I said, what's that? And she said that you agree to go out and promote it, because if you've sold me, you'll sell the American people. So I went to work on putting the book together. About 2 months before we went to press, I thought, I need a name on this book that really embodies the history of broadcast journalism. And at that time, Walter Cronkite was alive.
Yes.
Didn't know him, didn't know anybody who did.
Oh, wow.
So I wrote him a letter explaining what I was hoping to accomplish with this mix of media, and that his words should be the first in a book like this. And to my good luck, he agreed to write the foreword to the book. And also, Bill Curtis agreed to provide narration on the CDs, put the book out, and 6 weeks later hit the New York Times bestsellers list, just changed the whole trajectory of my career.
Tell everybody about who Bill Curtis is.
Bill is, you know, I think it embarrasses him to use the word legendary, but to me, he is a legend. You know, if we had Bill's voice, we could be somebody. That Bill would be the perfect narrator for We Interrupt This Broadcast in its original form. Now, that we've moved the concept to podcast. Bill is sort of, he sets the tone of every episode. And Brian Williams is doing the narration on the episodes.
And Brian brings that big time anchor image to the project that, of course, can never, ever duplicate Walter Cronkite, but is in the ballpark and the genre. So you've not only kept the basic team together, but you've kept the concept together of the narrator,
right,
of the host, and you sort of the background writer, creator, you know, showrunner, if you will.
Well, I'll tell you how this differs really in 30 seconds.
Yeah.
The book really sort of inspired the podcast. The impetus behind all of this, someone that we both know, Ron Hartenbaum, called me about a year ago. And he said, you know, of all of the books that you've done, which do you think would translate into best into podcast? And, you know, I think they all could lend themselves. They were all multimedia. But, you know, with We Interrupt This Broadcast, you know, part of the inspiration, Michael, you know, the pummeling
that journalism in general and broadcast journalism specifically has taken over the last 4 or 5 years with the, you know, the enemy of the people and those sorts of offensive notions, really sort of inspired, because you know broadcast journalists, I know broadcast journalists, you know, it's a profession, but it's a calling more than anything else. And so what we decided to do was to look at each of these events and have these stories told pretty much for the first time by the broadcast journalists who covered them. And, you know, even Walter suggested that broadcast journalists, he didn't use the exact term, but he described them as first responders. You know, and as the cliche goes, they do write the first draft of history. And I think that you'll find that the stories that they're able to tell, you know, of instances in breaking news where they have to check their emotions and in many cases had to check their own concern for their own safety, because they feel compelled to tell the story, to tell the news to the American people. And that really comes out in these episodes.
It's interesting you talk about the term, "we interrupt this broadcast." So the other day I was in a public place. I do not eat out a lot at this point in the pandemic. I'm very careful. But I was at one of these outdoor restaurants, and they had the television on, sort of in the bar behind the door to the patio. So when the door would open, I'd hear the TV. And all of a sudden I hear, "We interrupt this broadcast." This is the God's honest truth. I mean, it's coincidental. This happened a week ago. "We interrupt this broadcast." And I felt that my blood pressure go up. And I looked up real quick. And what was it? It was a scene from a television show or a movie or something in which they were showing an event happening, and it was fiction. And they typically would show in a movie depicting a big event, "We interrupt this broadcast," you know, and so I heard it, because you don't hear "we interrupt this broadcast" anymore. We hear a term called breaking news. And I want to get into that in a minute with you. But when I heard "we interrupt this broadcast," I immediately responded, knee-jerk, like you point out in the book, that term, that told us, oh, gosh, something big happened. And in a fraction of a second, at least my generation and generations that remember that era, you go through all kinds of things in your head in a fraction of a second, like, what happened? Because we all had the experience of Kennedy and the experience of 9/11, or so many of these other things. You know, where were you? What were you doing when you heard about the Oklahoma City bombing or whatever? So I wanted to share that with you, because that was a powerful term. "We interrupt this broadcast to bring you the latest from CBS News. The president has been shot." That type of thing. Oh, my God. Gosh, powerful stuff. Before we go further, you mentioned the whole thing, and we are in a very partisan world, and a lot of the listeners to this are Trump lovers as well as Trump haters. Are you saying that the media bears no responsibility for the mistrust that people have in it, is completely victimized by Trumpism, or is there a little bit of blame to go around to everybody?
Oh, there's definitely blame to go around. And that's one of the things that we're proudest of in this series. In almost every episode, we do sort of a self-analysis. Everybody that I've interviewed, I always ended by saying, what did you get right that day? What are you proudest of? And what did you get wrong that day?
Right.
You mentioned Columbine, for instance. David Bernkopf, who was head of CBS, I beg your pardon, head of CNN News Planning, was talking about how they covered Columbine. And he even says very candidly, he said, look, I'm going to reveal a dirty little secret. You know, in breaking news, there's no fact checking. There's no time to, you know, you have some kid who's been traumatized, who's coming out of that high school, and he wants to get on microphone or on camera, and you're interviewing him. You know, what comes out is what comes out and gets on the air. That's just the function of broadcasting. You know, it's sort of a double-edged sword. You know, broadcasting outpaced print because of its immediacy. Print, you know, oftentimes will have the luxury of being able to, you know, take its time and that sort of thing in considering the story and because of the function of how it has to get in front of its audience. But broadcast is instant. And, you know, we've had some very, like I said, candid and revealing explanations of how it is to blame on occasion. So no, I wasn't saying that to suggest that you know that it was all you know Trumpism or anything like that. No, it's there's plenty of blame to go around, but it's just that by and large, I think the broadcast journalists that I know are simply trying to do the very best job that they can, and sometimes. Especially in a breaking news situation, they don't get it right.
Now, more about the breaking news situation, because between we interrupt this broadcast as a phrase and mm-hmm. breaking news as a graphic, it's usually a graphic, breaking news, and then you see, whoever the anchor is going, we have some breaking news right now. The president belched, you know.
Yeah.
You're right. We're no longer going to have that heart skipping a beat when we hear breaking news. It's more like, oh, thank goodness they have some more information so I don't have to watch the same story every 20 minutes over and over again.
Yeah.
This has been an amazing change. And it goes back to that thing you pointed out before, time, the time factor. But what are your thoughts about the fact that we live in an era now with 24/7 news channels and them vamping and repeating and filling the screen with all kinds of razzle dazzle to keep people interested, including that breaking news? And the breaking news is usually nothing important, just another page in an ongoing story. What are your thoughts about the effects of this syndrome that we're living through?
Well, it certainly has desensitized us. You know, it's become very sensational. It's, I'm currently working on our second season, and one of the episodes is the rescue of Jessica McClure, which was really a watershed moment for CNN. It put them on the map because, you know, they were the only game in town when it came to 24/7 coverage. It was a wonderful creation of Ted Turner's. It demonstrated that news does continue. It isn't, you know, something that you can just encapsulate in 30 minutes once a day. But the double-edged sword of it all is that cable news is a voracious animal. I mean, is a big animal with a voracious appetite.
Mm-hmm.
And it constantly has to be fed. And so consequently, you do get a lot of vamping and a lot of reworking and in large part, you know, sort of a, you know, kind of a waste in many instances because but, you know, again, to kind of keep interest, they have to sort of put this feigned importance on some things, and that's why I think we've become so desensitized to breaking news. That said, you know, there are still moments that you mentioned 9/11, the anniversary of which we just celebrated. Mm-hmm. I think that's a case in point where you know broadcasts and interruptions you know will still be a part of our lives.
That's broadcasting executive and journalism historian Joe Garner talking about his new 12-part podcast series, We Interrupt This Broadcast. Before it was history, it was news. Check it out at We Interrupt This Broadcast on Apple Podcasts. If you want to hear the full conversation from which this excerpt was extracted, please visit mhinterview.com, where it will be posted this coming Tuesday. And that about does it for this latest installment of the Michael Harrison Wrap, an overview of the national conversation, looking back at the week of Monday, September 20th through Friday, September 24th, 2021. Looking ahead, I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about next week, including the ever-lurking unknown factor, that unanticipated surprise story that can take the national conversation spinning off in a totally unexpected direction. We sure do live in interesting times. I can be reached via email at michael@talkers.com. My podcast, The Michael Harrison Interview, can be heard at mhinterview.com. And if you want to stay in touch with the inner workings of the talk media industry, please visit talkers.com. The Michael Harrison Wrap. Our producer is Matthew B. Harrison. Thank you for listening.
The Michael Harrison Wrap is a production of Good Phone Communications in conjunction with Talkers Magazine and Talk Media Network. Copyright 2021, all rights reserved.